Okay, so welcome to the welcome to the afternoon session of the workshop. We are going to have two sub sessions of 2 talks each. In between, I guess it's coffee. Directly here, I hope you are ready after the lunch to attend this interesting talk. So the first one is going to be the epidemic resulting complex pathologies. It's going to be the speaker is Marianne Bobognan. So you can, you're welcome to introduce yourself if you would like to.
Just checking if the meeting is better to use this off.
Is better?
Yeah. Okay, so thank you very much. Thank the organizers for the nice invitation. Well, I know that it's a critical enough time, so I'll try not to make this weird. But please feel free to do so if you feel like. Anyway, so let's start. Well, I'm a physicist working on the field of complex networks. So today I will try to explain what is, in my opinion, the most important contribution for the field of complex networks to epidemiology, which is the understanding of the important role that the network topology plays on epidemic processes. Okay. First of all, I want to clarify that I'm not not only interested in the epidemic experiment of biological viruses, but also on kind of generic reaction diffusion processes in which you can model all sorts of dynamics, like, of course, biological viruses in human populations, but also computer viruses, rumor spreading, opinion dynamics, viral marketing, etc. So I will be talking about epidemiological models, but I'm thinking on this more general frame. Okay? So, because we are interested in the role of the topology in the epidemic properties of the system, I will restrict our analysis to the simplest epidemiological models, which are the SIS and the SIR. Unfortunately, I got an epidemiologist choose a different name for the infection rate, which is lambda now. I think it's, you are using beta or
yeah, right. Beta.
So I'm sorry for that. I apologize. But please, just to fix the notation, lambda is infection rate, so the rate at which an infected, a susceptible individual becomes infected in the presence or in contact with an infected node. And delta is the recovery rate, which is typical safety one, so it doesn't matter. Okay, for these two models, we know that there is a continuous phase transition. There is a healthy phase and an endemic phase. For the SIS, the order parameter is the prevalence, you know, the average fraction of the population in the steady state, whereas for the SIR, it's just the size of the outbreak. So that means that the fraction of individuals ever infected in the population, whereas in the order parameter is lambda, which is the infection rate. We know that there is a critical point and a critical rate here, such that when the infectious rate of the infectious agent is below this threshold, there is no macroscopic outbreaks, whereas when you are in this site, you have epidemic macroscopic. So we know from now classic results in network theory that for the SIS or for the SIR models, in kind of mean field approximation, this threshold, okay, depends on the network topology, but depends on the network topology in a very peculiar way. So the effect that the network topology has in the value of this, this value is not marginal at all. And the reason is that in the denominator, of course, this is, I use brackets to denote averages, okay? This is proportional to the average degree of the network, but it's divided by the fluctuation of the number, or the second moment of this of the number of contacts per moment. Well, you know that there are many heterogeneous networks out there. Well, we can discuss whether they are scale-free or they are not, but in any case, fluctuations are large, typically, so this number is typically very large, and if this is a truly stateful network, and this goes to infinity in the thermodynamic limit, meaning that this threshold goes to zero. So actually, you don't have anymore this feature of healthy phase and endemic phase, but you are always in the endemic phase, which is, of course, very dramatic from the epidemiological point of view. So today I will try to explain the results that we found concerning the values of this epidemic threshold, depending on the different topologies that you can, well, some of the topologies that you can find out there for different networks. Okay, I will talk about undirected networks which are locally trivialized, so without loops at all, basically the configuration model, but without regular degree correlations. I will be talking about semi-directed networks without loops. Okay, I will be talking about clustered networks in general. I will discuss later about weakly clustered or strongly clustered. And finally, I will talk about some similar. These first three topics are kind of old, so I will try to go very fast in these three, but I will try to concentrate in this last part of this.
What is semi-directed?
Semi-directed, I will explain later, but it's basically a directed graph in which you also have coexisting bidirectional connections. I will explain later. Okay, so let's start talking about the approaches that we use. You know that for the SIS, there are homogeneous mean field theories, heterogeneous mean field theories, pair approximation, master equation approach. This is a recent work, very nice. But be aware. But beware, in all these cases, this is something that I never see written in the papers, but it is implicitly assumed that all the temporal processes involved are Poisson processes. Okay?
That's so Markov theory applies.
Yes, yes. But it may not be the case, because here you assume that the distribution of time that a node is infected is an exponential distribution, and the distribution of time that it takes for a node that's susceptible to get infected is also exponential. Maybe for this case it's reasonable, but maybe for the recovery time it's not that reasonable. Okay? So beware that actually, as far as I know, there is no theory for arbitrary distributions of recovery times and infected times. Okay? In the case of the SIR, if you are not interested in the temporal evolution of the process, but in the final outbreak size, then we have percolation theory and generating functions. I will be mainly talking about percolation theory because there is a mapping between the SIR model and percolation theory. However, also beware that the mapping may not be exact in all cases. And let me explain why this is so. The mapping, as it is, it was originally defined, goes as follows. Imagine that you have an infected node here, which is in contact with a susceptible node, and you ask yourself, what is the probability of this event, of this node being infected? Okay. So this is the same as saying that what is the probability that this link is occupied? Okay, this is basically, this is what's called transmissibility. And this is just the probability that this guy becomes infected for a time tau, okay, remains infected for a time tau, okay, times the probability that this guy becomes, this guy remains infected, and this is the probability that this guy becomes infected in a time smaller than tau. Okay. So that, if you assume that the infectious events are Poisson processes, then if you plug this expression here, you recover the expression that was written in this paper, but not human. And the mapping goes to that as, then what you do is that you say that T is the bold occupation probability of the network, and then you don't care anymore about the dynamics or anything, just run just a bold percolation process in the network, you occupy every single node with probability T, and you compare with probability 1 minus T, and then you study the critical point. Okay. The problem with this approach is that, imagine that you have now an event like this one. Imagine you have an infected node here and two non-infected nodes. And you ask yourself, what is the probability of a double infection? What is the probability that these two guys become infected? Well, if you do the math, you will see that this is the probability that this guy remains infected for a time tau, times the probability that this guy becomes infected in a time smaller than tau, and this guy also becomes infected in a time smaller than tau. But notice that these two events are marginally dependent on the state of this guy. which means basically that this probability is not E squared, which would be the case if Bode-Percolation mapping wasn't there. Okay? So that was really explained in a couple of simultaneous papers by Miller, Penner, and Robbins. And they also show that, which is also interesting, is that the mapping can be exact if you map the Bode percolation, so the SNR model, SIR model, not to an undirected network, but to a bidirectional, semi-directed. Okay? And this is why I want to include the results for semi-directed networks that I will tell you. Of course, the mapping is exact if the recovery times is a delta function so that everybody recovers at the same time. Okay? And this is the case that I will consider. So I will basically consider Bode percolation in networks. Okay? So I'm assuming that we are in this case. So let's start with all results on undirected locally trivialized networks.
Just because I'm not familiar with this model, it's not possible to use those model Bode percolation, for example, for SIS or and the other those kind of.
No, well, the problem is that you can do that. No, for the SIS, no. It's only for the SIR.
And the other, the Vespignani Pasto Stator, be used SIS. In SIR, is not possible.
Well, I mean, you can do a heterogeneous mean field approximation.
Right.
Okay. But for the SIR.
Right. So you should repeat the same approach. It's possible.
But
to
you don't do that using differential equations. You do it using generating functions. So the approach is completely different.
Right.
It's completely different. Basically you start from a node and you analyze the branching process essentially. Mm-hmm. And you look for the critical point is the point at which the branching process goes forever.
And you think the differential equations cannot be modified to take into account the recovery?
Yes, but I think it's... Okay, so when you try to model the dynamics, you end up in trouble, because the differential equations are not describing actually the dynamics very well. But the final outbreak is, so in the mapping with Bode percolation, when it is exact, it is really exact. So, of course, for locally trivialized networks, so basically for the population. So, for the case of undirected locally trivialized networks, okay, we were able to manage to find an expression for these thresholds, which is, as you were explaining before, is the inverse of a maximum eigenvalue of some matrix. Actually, this is the inverse of the maximum eigenvalue of this matrix here that encodes the correlation structure of the network. Actually, this matrix is nothing but the coarse version of the adjacency matrix that we were using before.
Right.
The nice thing about this approach, here we are using a heterogeneous mean field approximation, where we write this matrix. The nice thing is that now you can work out what is the effect of specific patterns of correlation for different networks, because you have control of this probability. Basically, this probability tells you the probability that a node of degree k is connected to a node of degree k prime, let's say. Okay? So, okay, this is a general result, but then what you can prove is that this maximum eigenvalue goes to infinity when the fluctuation of the degree distribution also goes to infinity. That means that for scale-free networks, it doesn't matter the pattern of correlation that you have in your network, that the threshold will be always zero. The perforation threshold, the LTM threshold for the SIR and for the SIS is always zero if the network is scale-free, no matter what pattern of correlation you have. Okay. Well, there are some weird contra-examples, but in general terms, it's zero. So now let me say something about semi-directed graphs. Semi-directed graphs basically are networks in which you have directed links like this, and then undirected links simultaneously. Basically, an undirected link is just a couple of directed links pointing to opposite directions. Okay. And these type of graphs are important because real directed graphs, you find that the fraction of bidirectional links, okay, is much higher than the number that you would expect in a random case. So that means that for a real network, directed network, you have to consider these type of links as a separate entity. Okay? This is what we did in this theory. And it is also important because the mapping to Bode percolation that I was telling you before can be exact in one of these semi-directed.
basically we call this a directed network. The semi, I don't understand quite
well.
Right?
Well, semi because you have purely directed and undirected coexisting simultaneously. So yeah. it's not direct, completely directed, but well, call it directed.
What possibility do you think would make sense to substitute the undirected links with two directed links?
Yeah. Oh, this is what direction. It is. But this is what it is.
Oh, okay.
But the point is that if you have a random directed graph and you count the number of such events in a random case,
it's less than the reality.
It's extremely small. It's much.
Okay?
Well, actually, it's order one.
Right. But in reality, you have
whereas
more.
The number of links is order n, typically. Whereas in reality. There is a paper in which they measure a large number of directed graphs, and they measure this reciprocity of the links.
Yes.
So the fraction of links pointing in both directions. Okay? And they found that this number is extremely high as compared to random links. So that actually you have to consider these type of links as a different type in some graph. This one. So, as soon as you have directions in the graph, the connectivity, the structure of the network changes completely because there is a straddling component, which is a set of nodes in which there is always a path connecting a pair of nodes, a directed path. Okay? There is a in component, which is a set of nodes that can reach the strongly connected component but cannot go backwards. And then the out component, which is the set of nodes that you can reach from here but you cannot go backwards. So you have some kind of in component, component, and this intersection is strongly connected. So the point is that there is again a phase transition, and there is a point in which this type of structure becomes giant, becomes macroscopic. So it occupies a finite fraction of the nodes of the system. Okay, and we are interested in this phase transition. Well, also in this case, we were able to work out. Again, for tree-like networks, an exact theory in which the interpolation condition or the epidemic threshold, let's say, it's controlled by the maximum eigenvalue, but this time the maximum eigenvalues of this ugly matrix here, which contains the directed the information of directed links plus bidirectional links. Okay, so KO is the out degree, KE is the in degree, and KB is the bidirectional. So each node has some number of incoming neighbors, outgoing neighbors, and vibration. Of course, you can't recover the purely directed undirected case or purely directed case just by setting in degrees of directed links to zero. The nice thing is that if you further assume that the network is uncorrelated at two point levels, so that there are no correlations between the degrees of connected nodes, you can actually find an analytic expression for this eigenvalue. It turns out to be this ugly expression that involves the averages of the local properties of a node, basically the integral, of the degree and bidirectional. And the term which is more interesting is this term here that actually is coupling the bidirectional links with the directed link, because it involves the average of the product of the integral and the bidirectional degree of a single node. Okay? Now, of course, if this coupling is weak, then what you get is that the maximum eigenvalue from this expression is just the maximum between this term and this term. Here you, well, it's easy to understand because in this case, if this is basically zero, it means that the two networks are basically decoupled, completely decoupled. So you have a purely directed graph and a purely undirected graph coexisting on the same nodes. Okay, but then the connectivity structure will be given by the subnetwork that is percolating before. Okay? First, let's say. So you have this is the eigenvalue for a purely undirected graph, and this is the eigenvalue for a purely directed graph, uncorrelated.
So do we have results for the case of purely directed?
Yeah, this is one. This above this is equal to one. This is the nuclear point.
Okay, and also in general, without assumption on the graphs has been studied, because I don't know, I'm not
following. Well, then you will have to work out this, the same that you need, but for this adjacent symmetric that contains this.
But will be directed links, so will be not symmetric.
Not symmetric, and will be, yeah.
Will, but you don't know that has been studied.
No,
very
not that I know.
Okay.
So, but the point is that you may have situations in which the network is not able to percolate. So the epidemics, let's say,
is not able to propagate, to spread in the network, using only undirected links or only directed links, but the combination of the two things, thanks to this coupling term, allows the system to propagate. Okay? So that you may have a situation in which this number is smaller than one, this number is smaller than one, but the whole number here is above one, that the epidemics can propagate in the system using simultaneously the two diodes. Well, you can play a lot with this model, but I would not say anything more because I don't have time. So let me now say something about clustered. Well, clustered, as the first talk was. The first speaker was explaining this morning, clustering is still a complicated problem because as soon as you have loops in the network, you cannot apply generating functions, you cannot apply anything, and everything is amazing. But still, you can manage somehow in some situations to work out some approximations. In the case of weakly clustered networks, I will explain later what weakly clustered means. We also were able to find an expression for the threshold, which is given again from the maximum eigenvalue of one matrix, which is estimated about one, which in this case is this matrix here, that involves the correlation structure of the network, but also this term here, MKK prime, is counts the average number of triangles going through a particular edge that connects two nodes of the KKK prime. Okay? Well, you can prove that the maximum eigenvalue of the same network without clustering, okay, is smaller than the maximum with weak clustering, is smaller than the maximum eigenvalue of the same network without clustering, which basically means that weak clustering hinders propagation. So it makes the propagation of the epidemics more difficult.
More difficult the cluster?
Yeah. When you have clustering, basically what happens is that you have a node infected and you try to spread to the whole population, basically it's a branching process. Yeah, if you have clustering, some of the links that you infect your neighbors, and then the links of your neighbors, some of the links of your neighbors has to point to your local neighborhood. Okay? So you are wasting some links that are opportunities for the epidemics to spread. Okay? So in general terms, this is what happens. And this is why this weak clustering hinders propagation or makes the propagation of the epidemic more difficult. Nevertheless, we are also able to prove that the maximum eigenvalue with weak clustering goes to infinity when the fluctuation of the distribution goes to infinity, meaning that again, if the network is scale free, even if you have clustering and correlations or whatever you want, the threshold is still at zero. So there is no way that you can recover a final threshold only with clustering. What happens with the strong clustering? Well, strong clustering is completely different from weak clustering. And weak clustering, we define weak clustering as, do you know what the degree dependent clustering coefficient is? Well, the local clustering coefficient, you know, it's the fraction of your neighbors that are connected. The function C of K is basically the average clustering coefficient for nodes of a certain degree class. And you plot C of K as a function of the degree. Okay? We define weak clustering as those networks that has a degree-dependent clustering coefficient below this value, this function 1 over p minus 1, whereas strong clustering is in the opposite case. This definition is because in this case you can you have configurations in which the average number of triangles going through an edge, an average, is smaller than 1, whereas in this case this is above 1. Basically what you have is that in the case of weak clustering, what you have is that the triangles are disjoint, so that you can still work out some kind of generating function techniques. So this is kind of locally tree-like in a way. Whereas when you have strong clustering, all the edges are forced to share many triangles, and then it's impossible to disentangle this kind of stretch. Okay? So what we did was perform simulations on networks with the same level of overall level of clustering, so the scalar value for the clustering is the same, but changing whether the network has a strong or weak clustering. So here I show you a network with an exponential degree distribution. Q is the inverse of the equation probability, the bold observation. So this is the entire network, and here you have removed all the data. Okay? So the blue line is the network without clustering, so the pure configuration model. Okay? Okay, and the threshold is here, which is well predicted by the theory. Okay, the black circles here are the network with strong, with weak clustering, and as you can see, the threshold is below on the left of the threshold for unclustered networks. Whereas for strong clustering, the giant component, which is plotted here, is smaller, but then the threshold is on the right of this one. Okay, so that you can repeat the same for O. By the way, this curve corresponds to this. This is the degree-dependent clustering coefficient, and the gray area is the limit between weak and strong clustering. So this curve here, that is below this, the gray area triangles do not overlap. Whereas in this case, the red one is above this limit. That means that all triangles are forced to share triangles in the edges. So the point is that although the average clustering coefficient is the same, depending on whether you are in this situation, in weak clustering or strong clustering, the threshold moves to the left or to the right of the network without. And
they generate these networks.
Yes.
Are you keeping the degree distribution constant?
Yes, the same degree distribution. Identical degree distribution.
Are you keeping
about
neighbor degree distribution?
What about assortativity?
As much as we can.
Yeah. Okay.
As much as we can. Yeah. No, you know, no. There is a problem because clustering coefficient and degree corrections are not independent ones. So you cannot really change one without affecting the other. So, but this network, well, the algorithm that we use generates the most random network with the same degree distribution and with a given level of.
So strictly speaking, this is not really the effect of clustering, but there is also some additional
structure. But what we fix is clustering coefficient. Then the most random network that you can get without clustering generates some correlations, at 2-point correlation, but you cannot avoid that. Because there is no way that you can do that. It's completely impossible. Okay. So, well, for different networks as well. Okay, the explanation of this result is, well, you can understand this if you understand what is the key core of a network. The key core of a graph is the maximal subgraph which has k or more connections, so such that each node in this subgraph has k or more connections within the subgraph. Okay. So if you belong to the three core, let's say, that means that you have three or more neighbors within the three core. If you belong to the 10 core, means that you are a node which has 10 or more neighbors within this 10 core, and so on. Okay? So you can analyze a network and you decompose the sizes of the giant key core. Let's say the one core is the whole network, the two core is you remove all the nodes with degree one. Yeah, iteratively, and so on and so forth, and you measure what subgraph of the network remains, and then you plot the size of the key core as a function of k, so this is the key core index, okay? And what we see is that when the network has a strong clustering, the network develops a strong key core structure, okay? So this is an example for a very small network, and this is the I don't know which key core it is, but I think the green nodes here have, I don't know, 5 or 6 connections within the green nodes. So that what I'm trying to say is that the fact that you are forcing the network to have clustering, strong clustering, and the triangles are forced to share edges, and the network is built at random, it means that you are forcing the nodes, the local neighborhood of a node, to overlap with the local neighborhood of any other node in the network. That means that you are creating some structures which are extremely connected, okay, in this sense. That means that, for instance, this is a network with scale-free network with gamma 2.5, okay, and here we plot the size of the giant key core as a function of k for the network without correlations, without clustering at all, which is the blue one, and the network with strong clustering. When you see what is the size of the giant key core, you see that this is this red curve here that actually is, you have to understand that this curve is bounded by the cumulative degree distribution, which is the green line here, so it cannot be higher than this. But as you can see, you reach easily key cores of size 20, 30, 45, 60, 70. So there is a subgraph in this network in which each node has 60 or more connections within the subgraph. As you can imagine, this soup is a kind of core of the network which is extremely well connected and extremely difficult to break and to fragment. So that when you have clustering and you perform some epidemic spreading process or some bulk perforation process or whatever, there are two competing effects. One is the fact that at the beginning you start removing links, okay, these links that are not helping you to propagate epidemics. Okay, and this is why the size of the giant component is smaller than in the case of one clustering network. It's like saying, okay, so you are losing links that allows you to propagate the network, the infection further. But once you have reached, you have removed the major portion of the network, okay, then what remains is a subgraph which is extremely well connected. And at this point, this subgraph is extremely difficult to break. And this is what you observe here. Of course, this is for scale-free networks in which the threshold should be at 1, because it's 1 minus p. But still, you see that the red curve is always below the blue one, except when you approach the critical point in which the blue one goes faster to 0 and then the red one goes. Okay, so we have 15 minutes for the last part of the talk. Well, self-similar network. What is a self-similar network? Well, imagine that you have a graph. This is a network. Okay. And imagine that you extract some subgraph out of this graph. Imagine that in this example, my rule is I draw a circle here, and whatever is inside the circle is kept, whatever is outside is removed. Okay, so that I get this subgraph. This is clearly a subgraph of the original graph. Okay. I can repeat the same procedure here. I can draw another circle here and remove whatever is outside the circle, and I get this subgraph. So on and so forth. So what I have at the end is a hierarchy of nested subgraphs, like a Russian doll. Okay, so this subgraph is containing this, this one is containing this, this one is containing this. So. Well,
excuse me. How do you construct your graph? I mean,
you will see later.
Happy.
For the moment, this is just a graph.
Yeah,
and some rule that tells you how to extract a subgraph out of it.
Right.
So imagine that you can define any rule that you want to extract a subgraph out of a graph. Okay? My rule is that I don't know, all nodes with degree in this range are kept and the rest are removed. Okay?
Or also not related criteria, not related to node degree.
I'm not saying anything about the rule, it's just a rule that extracts a subgraph. In this case, my rule is to draw a circle and say whatever is inside is kept.
Right, but that depends on how you.
Yes. For the moment, just the general. Of course, the original graph belongs to some center, okay? And this is, so imagine that this is a graph that is a realization of some model, okay? And is a realization of some model with some parameters. Let's call this ensemble G of alpha, okay? When you do this transformation, this subgraph, in general, will belong to a different ensemble, GT, that I call G. And there is no reason why this ensemble should be the same as this one. Okay? So we say that the network is self-similar with respect to this transformation when this is the case. Except that the parameters, so when the transformed ensemble, so this graph belongs to the same ensemble as this one, except that the parameters of this graph are different from this one. This is our definition of self-similarity. Self-similarity in the sense that you are a graph that you contain another graph within you that belongs to the same ensemble as yourself, but maybe with some values for the parameters.
Basically what you're saying is that any subgraph has the same characteristics, that you have a homogeneous view, that locally you see the same.
Yeah, like a fractal. Yeah. The only difference is that it may be the case that the parameters changes from, let's say, imagine. You will see later that the average degree of this graph is different from the original.
But you are staying in the same class.
The same ensemble, same model.
Yeah, you start with, for instance, an average training graph, and
it's a variable training graph, but maybe with a different average degree.
Yes.
Okay. Let's say something else. Okay?
Yeah. So what do you mean by an ensemble? Oh, okay. I'm a physicist, so he ensembled all this.
Have you stopped that just being an
okay, ensemble, right? Okay, so we are talking about random graphs here, and an ensemble, roughly speaking, is a set of, so, the set of all possible adjacency matrices with some probability measure associated to each graph. So you have some model that generates, given adjacency metric, some probability. So actually, the ensemble contains the full, actually all possible graphs, except that each graph is weighted by the probability of what's happening. Okay. And here is an instance, the typical instance, let's say the typical instance of this. Typically, the network examples are self-averaged, which means that if the network is large enough, single realization of the network is a good representative of the sample. So you don't really need to repeat to generate many networks to have a good view of the sample.
Okay.
Okay,
so I'm sorry, this might be a really stupid question, but wouldn't it be the case that if you pick the right model for generating the graph in the first place, that every transformation will be self-sample?
Not any, why any?
I don't know.
Why any transformation? I mean,
but having made a transformation, can you not pick an original model that gives you
no.
things that fit it with a different set of parameters?
But
maybe you want to do it with just a few parameters.
Well, yeah, of course, I have a few parameters, but
if it's a stupid question, ignore it.
Sorry?
If it's a stupid question, just ignore it.
No, it's a stupid question, but
it's a difficult question.
So you are like a procedure in which after the transformation look for an ensemble that is self similar. I haven't even thought about that, but yeah.
I mean, if you look at allow for an enormous amount of parameters, can't you make it self similar?
Well, I don't like too many parameters.
No, okay.
But that's three at most.
Yeah. So, would this be an example? If I have a configuration,
I will give an example right now.
Okay.
Like, if I can follow correctly, like, is this transformation is something like if I have a network of, say, transportation network of whole Spain, then I take only of the Catalonia.
Yes.
Then I take up only of Girona.
Yes. And we have exactly the same, belongs to the same set, except that maybe some parameters has changed. But the
values of the parameters will be changing, but
yeah, any ensemble is defined by some parameters. Let's say, for the end already, the other
thing
is a
parameter.
Okay.
Okay.
Same topology. Exactly the same topology. Okay, so now let me show you a couple of examples, actually three, if I have some time.
I think you have more time because we are discussing them. So,
okay, so imagine that we build the following graph, okay? You start with a set of nodes, a fixed number of nodes n, and you assign each node some hidden variable, kappa, which is distributed as a power law. Then you connect two nodes with hidden variables kappa and kappa prime with some probability, okay, which is a function of the product of the hidden variables kappa and kappa prime. So actually I use kappa because this is going to be the expected degree of the node. Okay? So imagine that what I'm saying is that the probability that two nodes are connected in this graph. So first I have the nodes and then I go pair after one by one and they say, okay, this node is connected with this probability, yes or no? Okay, yes, and generated links or not. And the probability of such bend is some function of the product of the degrees of the two nodes that I'm looking. In principle, this function can be anything, but if you choose this function to be this Fermi-like distribution, okay, then it comes out that the graph that you are generating is maximal level. Okay, basically, what you are saying is that if you plug here new kappa kappa prime in this expression, you get something that for the small values of this argument, this is goes like new kappa kappa prime. This is just a configuration model.
So, what's maximally random?
is the symbol that maximizes the channel entropy under given constraints.
Okay.
So the most random that you can generate, given that, so what is the configuration model? It's the maximally random graph with a fixed degree distribution. Is that
correct? So you don't care about correlation, you don't care about velocity, you don't care about anything, you only fix the degree of each node, and you build the network in the most random way that you can, and this is the configuration node. This is what I am doing here, but instead of fixing the actual degree of each node, I'm fixing the expected degree of each node. This is a trick because this allows you to because in this case, each link is an undirected is a random event which is independent of the rest of the links. So it's an independent event, which is kind of nice mathematical. But you can prove that this maximizes the entropy of the
shell.
Yeah, I can show you. But actually, you see, what is the configuration model? The probability of connection probability for the configuration model, kk prime divided by the average degree times n. Is that correct? So mu actually is this inverse of the average degree times n. The only thing is that I don't fix the actual degree but the expected degree. And the fact that this function is not this simple function, but this has this term here, is because you cannot build uncorrelated networks at the level of 2 point at the degree, so at the 2 point level, if the network is still free. You have to put some correlations if you want to close the network, otherwise it's impossible. So you cannot just choose this number here because otherwise it could happen that this number is above 1, which is possible because this is a problem. Okay, this is a simple one. This is the most simple one. Now let me show you another model which is kind of similar but more interesting, which is a model in which you also just start from a set of nodes and then you assign each node some hidden expected degree, it's expected degree according to a power law like this, but on top of that you place also each node in a circle. You can do it also in a sphere or in any dimensional space. But let's put it in a circle, such that the size here is just proportional to the value of kappa, so the expected degree of the node. And then you connect pairs of nodes here. Of course, now you can define a physical distance. It's a physical distance, the length of this arc. And now you connect every pair of nodes with a probability, which is some function, arbitrary function, well, it has to be integral, of the physical distance divided by the product of degrees. Okay. Well, the motivation for this type of models is it's very clear in the case of the airport menu. The airport menu, you know, is the so nodes are cities and connections are there is a direct flight between them. And it's clear that there is some kind of distance effect because there are associated some cost associated with distance. Okay. But it is also true that two cities that are very important because they have a big population are more likely connected regardless of the distance because they are big. Okay? So in some sense, this type of, let's say, gravity law tries to mimic this type of behavior, so actually it reproduces very well in many real interesting methods. In both cases, you can prove that the expected degree of a node with some hidden variable kappa is just proportional to kappa. So let's think about kappa as the expected degree or the degree. But you can prove that the distance is just the power of the gamma exponent that you just choose. These are stimulation results, but the nice thing about this second model is that you can tune the clustering level of the network because the... Oh, sorry, I forgot to say that... Oh, okay, it's not pretty, doesn't matter. You can tune the clustering of the network between zero and some constant value. This model is nice because you can fit many real systems like the internet. This is the real internet autonomous system level. This is the metabolism of the collide. This is a bipartite graph, but still you can do it and it works beautifully. But okay, let's go on and move on. And what about the transformation? Let me define the following simple transformation. Imagine that our transformation is let's fix a threshold degree and let's remove all nodes that have a degree below this threshold. And let's keep the rest. Okay, so you start with the original graph, which belongs to some ensemble G of alpha, and then you transform a network in the form of you extract subgraphs by just choosing different values of k. If k is equal to 1, this node will be removed, and this node will be removed, and you will get this subgraph.
If k2 is equal to 2, you will get this subgraph. If k2 is equal to 3, you will get this subgraph. This is what I mean. Okay. Now, what I'm showing, what you see here is actually a realization of this second model that I was showing you. So this actually, this circle is the position in the circle, and the only thing that I did is to map the radial coordinate to the degree of the expected degree of the node. So nodes with high degree are close to the center, and nodes with small degree are in the boundary. Okay? So that actually, the transformation that I just described is exactly what I was doing in the beginning, just drawing a circle, and whatever is in the circle is kept, whatever is outside the circle is not. Okay. So, now I will skip all these mathematical details. Just believe me that this is the definition of the ensemble in the model. This is the definition of the ensemble of this subgraph. Just believe me. Actually, you can see it here, but you can see that this subgraph actually belongs to the same ensemble of this subgraph, with the only difference that the average degree of this subgraph is the average degree of this subgraph multiplied by a factor which is the ratio between the sizes of this and this, which is this n over nt, to some power that depends on the degree. Okay? Good. So, we checked that in real networks. For instance, here you see the degree, the average degree of the subgraph as a function of the ratio between the sizes of the original graph and the subgraph, okay, n over nt. So what you see is that if gamma is between 2 and 3, this is a growing function of this n over nt. So this is what we observe in real networks, like this is actors, airports, this is English internet, the autonomous system level, for the interaction network, the web of trust, and so on. And if you rescale now by this factor, okay, by this, so you multiply this axis by this third here, you would expect to have a constant around 1, and this is what you observe, okay? Except for the airport, because I don't know, it has an exponent between smaller than 2. It's 1.8, and the theory is not, it doesn't work for exponent. But in any case, it seems that this type of behavior is actually observed in real networks. So real networks have this kind of cores of superconnected nodes. And the deeper you go into this hierarchy, the higher the average degree in this core. Okay? So they are better and better and better and better. But this is very clear for the internet, for instance, but it's not that clear for other networks. But
it seems that this is a characteristic related to the robustness of the network. Connectivity
yeah,
of the
core
gives the robustness
yeah.
against attack that
can
be
randomly
targeted.
Yeah, but the nice thing is that in many other real networks, it's happening also the same. So, I don't know, the web of trust, the protein core interaction network.
Well, biological networks are also a proof yeah. of robustness evolving in time.
Okay. So, well, I will skip this. You can also higher order level correlations, and you see this some similarity of these subgraphs. Well, this is a 2-point correlations, 3-point correlations. I will skip all this because I don't have time. But let's go back to percolation or epidemic spread. This property allows you to prove the absence of epidemic threshold or percolation thresholds in this type of networks. In a very easy way. Imagine that you are in this situation. You have a sub-similar graph in which the average degree of the subgraph is a growing function of this ratio. That means that if gamma is between 2 and 3, the average degree of this guy is higher than the average degree of this guy. Okay? Now, let's plot the typical phase transition for the epidemics or for percolation, giant component, as a function of the average degree, which is also a good control parameter. So you know that there is a critical average degree. If you build networks with an average degree below this threshold, the network is just a fragmented graph. And if you build the network here, then with this average degree, you have a giant component. Now, imagine that you are in this situation. Let's assume that there is a final threshold, okay? Let's suppose that there is a final threshold, and we are in this situation. Now, of course, you can generate a graph that has an average degree, which is, for instance, here. But well, you have this average degree, sorry, this graph with this average degree, but this average degree will contain a subgraph, which according to this rule, will have an average degree that is higher and higher and higher, and maybe this is here. But
since the graph belongs to the same ensemble, the phase diagram is exactly the same, which means that this subgraph actually is percolated, has a giant component. So you are grabbing a contradiction, which means that actually the threshold must be here, for sure. But of course, there is nothing special about this point, which means that you can extrapolate this argument, and you end up saying that, concluding that the threshold must be zero. But not because the fluctuations of the degree are infinite, but because of the network is self-synchronous. And of course, you will tell me that you already knew that the scale-free graphs have zero percolation threshold or a degree threshold. Well, these are simulation results showing that this is true. But think, how come? 5 minutes? Think, for instance, about growing graphs, growing networks. What is a growing network? A growing network is a network in which, at a certain moment of time, you have some graph, okay, let's say time t, and then some time t plus 1, a new node appears. And this new node joins the network with some number of connections that are chosen with preferential attachment or some any other rule to the existing network, and then you will have the network time t plus 1. So, actually, time in growing networks is a good parameter to extract subgraphs of the network. Of course, if you keep doing this procedure, you will end up with a graph which is asymptotically infinite and has a topological properties which are stable. So you expect that your model generates a graph that doesn't change. So doesn't matter, for instance, you generate a Malabasi-Albert model, you don't really need to go up to infinity. So you can generate a graph with a million nodes, and this graph with a million nodes will have the same properties as the graph with 10 million nodes. But of course, the graph with 1 million nodes is inside the graph of 10 million nodes. Yes? So the graph and the subgraph belong to the same ensemble in the thermodynamic limit, which means that growing networks are, by definition, let's say. The only problem is that they are designed to have constant average. So you have a Barabasi-Albert graph with 10 million nodes, an average mean, let's say 5, and a subgraph of filtering by age, let's say, okay, with 1 million nodes, will have the same average degree, 5. Okay.
Yeah, what about, like, I understand what you mean by growing network, like the old links are always there, but what about evolving the network, like, as I add
you
one node, yeah, I remove yes. some of the old connections.
Well, depends on the model. Not all models are self-synchronous.
Okay.
This type of growing okay. graphs are, but there are, I know some models that are also self-synchronous in there. It's very wiring, but in general, I mean, I'm not saying that all networks in the world, or all models in the world, are subsymmetric. Some, but in this case, yeah. But the average degree, the subgraphs are constant. Now, you can modify this model very easily to allow for a growing average degree in the subgroup. So imagine you have the same graph as before, and then at time t, a new node appears with some number of connections, which is not constant now, but is some function of time. So that nodes that join the network at the beginning have a higher average degree, so average in, so the number of new links is higher, and then the last one has just M0 connection. Okay? So other than that, these connections are made randomly among the already existing nodes. No preferential attachment at all, no. Okay? So that you have this model, you can prove that, of course, if this parameter, remember that, eta is this parameter here, okay? Eta here, between 0 and 1. And when eta is equal to 0, the network has an exponential degree distribution. We knew that. But if eta is above 1, above 0, the degree distribution is a power log with an exponent, 1 plus 1 over eta. And you can also prove that the ensemble is similar. With an average degree in the subgraph, average sub t, which is the average degree of the original graph times n over n theta to the power 1 over gamma minus 1. Now, in this model, we have a subsimilar graph with a growing average degree in the subgraphs, and there is no limitation for the value of gamma that you can choose. Because this is always a growing function of n over n theta. That means that, for instance, you can generate a graph with a gamma equal to 5, which is not at all scale free. Okay, so you agree that gamma equal 5 is not very much scale free. But still, this is a growing function, which means according to our theorem, the epidemic threshold should be over, the population threshold should be zero. So this is what we need, for instance, for with simulation, these are simulation results. Well, basically the position of this peak, well, this is susceptibility of the giant component, and the position of the peak is the critical point for different sizes, how it approaches zero. And it approaches zero as a power law, which means that we are indeed so the threshold is really, really zero. So just to conclude about this last part, just to say that subsimilarity is a property, a topological property, which is observed in many real networks, okay? And it provides, I mean, this minimalistic proof of the absence of perpolation or epidemic thresholds, okay? And what is, for me at least, most interesting is that the same reasoning can be applied to any other process, any other phase transition taking place on this network, okay? With the only condition that the critical point of this phase transition is a monotonous function of the average connectivity. As soon as you have a network, sorry, a process that undergoes a phase transition in which the critical point depends monotonously with the average degree, the same proof applies, and then you will find that one of the phases disappears because of this effect of the core. So I think stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.